This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time. This episode with Jack Heath is one of three we did on location in Canberra with our partner, the ACT Writers' Centre. You'll hear the sound quality is different to our normal smooth studio sound, but we promise it's totally worth it to hear the insights Jack shares from his career so far after being published at the tender age of 17.
Catherine, what's happening this week?
This week I'm planning parts of the book launch.
Yes, the book launch. It's so exciting.
It's kind of horrible already. Like I can feel, I remember forgetting when I had my wedding that I actually don't like being the centre of attention.
Well, so you are going to like this, okay? You're going to like it. It's a celebration.
It is a celebration.
What do you want?
So I have invited pretty much anyone I have seen since the book got signed.
As
that's
you should.
Been my default thing. So I've invited lots of people, but kind of there's a lot of special people that probably won't be able to make it because my brother and sister-in-law and their family will be overseas. Yeah. My other brother lives overseas. I have an uncle and aunt who are in Canberra. They'll be overseas. So it just feels like, people actually have lives outside of my book, but.
Not for the that little part when your book comes out, no one else has a life. It is just you and your book. A little moment of self-absorption, that's okay.
So I'm planning the guest list. I am going to have it at readings in Carlton, which will be good.
The literary heart of Melbourne.
And they're redoing it at the moment. Yeah, so I'm hoping that we'll have like a great space.
Like a champagne, one of those towers in the middle overflowing.
Is that too much to us?
No. Gosh, no.
But yeah, I do have some questions for you.
Go, shoot.
Okay. So did you invite everybody you know to your launch?
So this is actually quite funny because I did. I separated my launches. So I had a launch at my local bookstore it was run by my local bookstore. It's actually at my old high school that I invited my kind of extended family and local Elthamy folk too.
Yep. And so kinder people.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of
neighbors.
Community.
Yep.
And I had one in the city that was kind of the official launch that was at Hill of Content.
Yep.
But what was hilarious is that I put together my list a little bit like a wedding and, you know, you pull all your networks in and you're like, you know, I'm going to have 300 people. And Black Ink went, well, you probably won't. And kept on doing this thing of like anticipate less, like and telling
well,
your stories about
said
people not
you'll
coming.
Probably get, Jane's the publicist at Text, who's lovely. She was like, we expect 40%. Of
yeah.
Who you
yeah. And so they have data to like, this is proven. But I kept pushing a little bit, partly because I knew that if I had a sense that a lot of the people, like, you know, my English teacher or whatever, were going to come.
Yeah.
And I knew that they wouldn't all fit at Hill of Content. So I did split it. And, of course, they did come, which was amazing and incredible. And I remember my publicist going, oh, they really did come. And me thinking right to the end, oh, my gosh, you guys still thought that I was bullshitting you. So
maybe not bullshitting, just very naive.
Very confident and very naive. Yeah. But I was, that was one thing that I was confident on, that I could pull in my darling friends and that they would come this time, the first time.
Okay. So say you, so in planning for the launch, and this is getting a bit ahead of myself, cupcakes.
So I did cupcakes for the Eltham one with pictures, skylarking pictures on the front, and they were divine and the most beautiful things I've ever seen. But of course you don't want anyone to eat them because yep. they look so beautiful. Wine and cheese for the Hill of Content City one.
Did you pay or?
No. So my publisher put on my city launch and I paid for the wine and cake and a musician at my Eltham launch.
Yep. I think texts are paying for mine, which is great.
It's not expected, though. I mean, we should put this out. No, that's... This is a different thing. Not everyone gets a launch.
Who launched your book?
I asked Lucy Treloar to launch my book.
Ah.
And she also did... what do you call the thing? She said nice things about it, whatever that is called.
Oh, a blurb.
Yeah, and yep. She was on the cover.
So was that on the cover when it came out or was that for a second round of printing?
No, that was on the cover when it came out, yep. Lucy's one and Emily Biddo's, I think. And Lucy Treloar was delightful and spoke beautifully. So like all the things, you have no idea what to do, right? So I think I was worried about who was getting her a gift. Did I do that? Did the publisher get her a gift? I think they yep. got her flowers. They got me flowers maybe. Or I got someone flowers. I bought Aviva a gift, yep. gave it to her then. Like, oh. It's all very complicated.
So you gave a gift
To Aviva. Yeah, but very small gift kind of that fitted in a card, like a piece of jewellery.
Okay.
And so Aviva spoke, Lucy spoke, I spoke.
Yep, okay. I do remember being there. I remember you said, which I nearly put in my acknowledgements and claimed as my own, that you were... About Gracie and Etta, you were very proud of the book, but you were most proud.
I
of
was,
Gracie and Etta.
And that was actually that
was very cute.
That ruined me because they were there, and because it was so crowded and such a tight space, we'd put them up. They were on Adam, my partner, and my dad's shoulders, and the look on their face still is completely and utterly priceless because it was like Mum speaking. And all these people are listening to her. It was a real thing for them. So that I think that was really important for them to be there too.
Yeah, Tilly and Oscar will be very excited.
Oh, my gosh, they'll be so excited.
standard line written in each book when signing. And do you use your credit card signature?
Okay, two very quick silly stories.
At work. Practicing my signature.
Oh, that is mortifying,
Jack, who sits next to me, was like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So I did my first, I don't know, 200 or something that I went into Black Ink to sign that they were shipping up to Booktopia. I did with my, like, really quickly. They had, like, coffee and water and all these things spread out for me and then they were like, oh, you're done. And I was like, yeah, like, it's just my signature. It didn't take very long. And then someone, one of my very practical friends said, you didn't put your credit card signature in there, did you? And I was like, yeah, like, it's my signature. She was like, no, you don't do that. So then I started printing. Never and then someone else said, you know, people want to see that it's your name unless you're Winton or someone. Yeah. Know, they want to actually see that it's your name and not a scribble. And my signature is a scribble. So now I kind of do a more printed name, I suppose. My standard line was here's to friendship.
Yep.
But two things that I did in the signing line. You need to get someone to do the post-it note thing.
Yes.
And that is more so because you will forget the name of people you know really well.
Yes.
And mortifyingly, the first two people who came up were fellow students from RMIT who I know really well, blanked. I just completely blanked on both of their names. And, of course, you must know their name because then you have to write it in the book. So
Mark Brandy did that to me. Yeah. Well, we didn't know each other well, so it was actually okay. But he just signed his name.
Yeah, and, you know, your aunts and uncles and people like that, they'll get up in the publicist's face about, like, she knows who I am, but make them insist because it's like your best friend, you're going to forget their name.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I did was wrote in one of my dear friends who I went to school with, like, I wrote something about here's to friendships that are long and hard or something. And like as I'm writing it, because I was trying to be heartfelt and like you're special to me, and it was just the worst. I tried to take it back. And
John Marsden did that to me once. As a kid, I got him to sign a book, or as a teenager, and he spelled my name wrong.
Yeah,
kind of thing. He was kind of then scribbling bits of it out.
But I think you just have to make it standard for yourself, because if that person, like your Year 8 English teacher who came to mine, who like I was so overwhelmed by that emotion. You can't write something pithy and wonderful and incredible for them right in that moment.
Yeah.
You have to.
Well, it's a bit like thinking a great speech can be spontaneous.
Exactly. It can't. Have you started workshopping what you're going to write? Like what's going to be your little thing?
Oh, I thought you meant for the speech. No, I haven't, but I'll have to think of something.
Yeah, and other people, you know, like I've seen Chrissy Neen at Brisbane Writers Festival. She had a stamp.
A stamp's quite good.
Yeah, which was cute.
I
saw Catherine
Julie
Lacey did.
Has a jacket.
Julie Coe has a jacket, which is amazing. But for your signing,
lend itself to jackets.
You know, you want a statement about biscuits or
yes,
whatever it is.
Yeah,
Catherine Lacey wrote It's Not Love's Fault in her book that was kind of about love. You know, nice. You just want a little something.
Some little line. Mm-hmm. I have to think of that. Last question. Kate.
Oh, gosh.
Will you launch my book?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. This is like a marriage proposal. Of course I'll launch your book.
Thank you.
You guys should come to the launch. It'll be amazing. You should get someone more famous than me.
I want you.
It's all getting very emotional.
Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Canberra author Jack Heath to The First Time. As of February 2018, Jack is the fourth best-selling fiction author in Australia. He has written more than 20 action-packed books for kids and one disturbing crime novel for adults. His novels have been nominated for many awards, translated into several languages, and optioned for film and television. First published as a teenager, in the course of research, Jack has trained with firearms, performed street magic, visited morgues and prisons, travelled, and read only books by women for a year. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, to get started, let's talk about your first novel, The Lab, which came out in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
You started writing it as a teenager.
Yes.
Tell us how that happened.
Well, I'd always been a big reader, particularly in primary school. I had awful ear infections for the better part of a year when I was in year five, and so I couldn't do much other than read. And I had this wonderful school librarian who made sure that I was always kept. She was one of those great librarians who just, you know, handpicks stuff for individual students. So I always had stuff to read, and that gave me good storytelling instincts. And I knew that I wanted to be a writer. I don't remember a time when I wasn't already telling people, oh, when I grow up, I'll be a writer. Like, as soon as I discovered that that was a job that a person could have, I knew I wanted it. But I didn't actually start until I was 13, partly to impress a girl. it would be unfair of me to leave that out, because that was a big part of the central impetus. I remember saying to this girl, so I'm going to be a writer when I grow up. And she's like, really? What sort of stuff do you write? And I was like, well, nothing yet. That's why I said, when I grow up. I haven't done anything right now. So I started right away. But also, I was pretty bored with the books that we were being given to read by the school in year seven and year eight. There was a lot of, I guess, social realistic. At the time, I called it like misery fiction. It was all books about, you know, dealing with your parents' divorce and eating disorders and school bullying and stuff. And I was a big reader, but I also played a lot of video games. So I was looking at the video games I liked and looking at the books that I was being given to read, and I kind of just mashed the two together. I knew that reading could be exciting, and I knew that these books didn't interest me as a 13-year-old boy. So I started writing about helicopters and explosions and kung fu and stuff.
So that was more the inspiration than other thriller.
Yeah, that's right. It was a reaction against what I was being given, rather than an imitation of other things that I already liked. Although I do have to say, so, I mean, writing a book is a pretty big project, especially when you're a teenager. So when I was a couple of years in, and probably only about 25,000 words into the manuscript, my dad gave me Ice Station by Matthew Riley to read, and I discovered that not only had I not invented the concept of the action novel, there were other people doing it much better than I was doing it. So that did inspire me to kind of step up my game a little bit. So when I was 17, I finished the draft. I read it, rewrote it, and sent it off to a publisher, and it got picked out of a slush pile, which statistically almost never happened. So I feel... I never recommend that to anyone as a strategy. Like, the way I got published is not the way anyone else should get published, because I was just basically a lottery winner. But I've spent I've spent the last sort of 11 years capitalizing on that lucky break.
So did you have a mentor or any readers along the way, or just edited it yourself? And
I gave it to friends of mine. I showed it to them, including the girl I had a crush on. Her feedback was very useful.
Still had the crush? 5 years later.
Oh, she was really special.
Did you get the girl?
Yes, not as such. didn't work out, but that's okay. We're both Much happier married to other people, I think.
You still know her though?
Oh, yeah. She lives in Melbourne, but we keep in touch. So she and many of my other friends read my work. My parents did. Basically, I would let anyone read it who expressed even the slightest interest in sci-fi or reading. And whatever their feedback was, I'd take it on board. But no, I didn't know any other writers. I didn't have any other writing mentors. There were probably a couple that I had met, but none that I exchanged my manuscript with. Like I remember being a bit starstruck by when I met Jackie French when I was in like year six or something, but I didn't have a book to show her. So no, mostly I was just finding my own way.
And do you remember the moment the publisher called you or when you found out?
It was a letter rather than a call. Basically what happened was I sent it off to them. I remember literally kissing the package goodbye for luck and then kind of stuffing it into the post box. And then when I got a letter back, the letter was... It wasn't quite a no, but it wasn't quite a yes either. Basically, they said, look, we like your manuscript. It's got style. However, I see from... So I'd sent them just the first three chapters and a plot synopsis because that was what you're supposed to do. And they said, you've said that the novel is 45,000 words long and typically a novel for adults, which is what I had pitched them at the time, is at least 80,000 words. So it's probably best if we send it back to you. And I remember being really excited, firstly, to hear anything from a publisher. And secondly, my parents pointed out that the name at the bottom, Kate Patterson, Pan Macmillan, was listed in the thank yous of Ice Station by Matthew Riley. So nice. I was like, wow, this is so close to what I aspire to be like. So basically, I said... Hold on, I can make it 80,000 words long. So I spent the next year or so not exactly padding it out. Like I added extra plot twists and stuff and rewrote various things. And then it was 90,000 words long and then I sent it back to them. And they said, look, we still like it. It's very impressive. These extra twists seem really good. But it's reading much more like a YA novel, and YA novels typically aren't 90,000 words long. They're typically a fair bit shorter, at the most, 70,000 words. So I went, okay, and I went back and did another draft where I slashed away 20,000 words worth of stuff. So this, I think, was where I actually became... I'd love to pretend that I was, some child wonderkind prodigious genius when I was submitting my first draft, but I absolutely was not. I knew how to spell and I knew how a story worked sort of instinctively, but I hadn't been trained and I didn't know very much. So, but that process of making it 40,000 words longer, 45,000 words longer, and then making it 20,000 words shorter, and then going through this rigorous copy editing process, that was where I actually learned to write. It was in the editing rather than the writing.
And did you enjoy the editing process?
Oh, no, I was a lazy teenager. I hated it. Yeah. I enjoy it now. Now I've done this enough times that the editing, I go... Oh, I can see this coming together. I look at particular sentences or particular scenes and go, this works really well. Or I look at other scenes that aren't working so well and I go, okay, they're not working, but I know how to fix it. And that feels like quite a creative process. But in the first time, I definitely had an attitude of, what do you mean I have to write it again? I think that's pretty typical. And there's no way around it. Like you can't just tell young writers, yes, you'll need to read your work over and over and over again and write it over and over and over again. It's just something that you have to experience.
What, that first time?
Yeah.
What were the highlights?
There were lots, almost too many to name. At the risk of sounding mercenary and capitalist, getting my first advance check was pretty exciting. It was something like $4,000, which was probably more money than I'd ever had.
That's a good advance, though.
Yeah, not bad. And I spent I spent a lot of it on shoes, believe it or not. I went out and bought this. I was a big Marilyn Manson fan at the time, so I went out and bought these huge New Rock boots, sort of moon boot, motorcycle boot type things. These days, whenever I meet a new author or one who I'm interested in, I always ask them what they spent their first advance check on, because you tend to get, I feel like you get maybe a better sense of the person than you might in some other.
Yes, true.
Especially since the answer typically isn't rehearsed, because no one asks that question. But when I asked Paolo Bacigalupi, for example, he wrote The Wind-Up Girl, and he said, oh, straight into the war chest. Like, you didn't spend a dollar of it, like, straight onto the mortgage. Right. And I was like, yeah, that tells you something about that person. Absolutely. And Bret Easton Ellis, just, he told me he went to a bar and just said, drinks are on me, and then it was all gone by the end of the night, which is such a Bret Easton Ellis thing to do, you know. But anyway, so that was a highlight. But most of the other highlights along the process, besides like being mailed a box of copies of my book that I wrote and just kind of staring at it in, because I guess I'd held so many books in my hands over the years, it was just surreal to see my own name on one, you know. But the highlights had mostly been the people I had the opportunity to meet along the way. So all these people in the publishing industry who were such well-read people. I mean, I guess most of the people I knew at that point, a lot of my friends were musicians rather than book people. So, I mean, they would read, but they weren't happy to kind of sit down and talk about books for hours in the same way that these publishing industry people were and that I was interested in. And also I got to meet a lot of other authors and ones I admired, including Matthew Riley and Marcus Zusak and all these other, and Jackie French I'd already met, as I said. But it's a different experience meeting an author you admire when you also have a book. Like, I don't want to say authors are suspicious of their readers. That's not quite right. But when you're, I'm not on the same level as those people, to be clear, but because I had my own book, they could talk to me with, they knew I had some assumed knowledge, like some various things about the process, that we could have a mutual complaint about. Sometimes it's just fun to sit around with other authors and complain about things that you wouldn't dare to say in front of readers because it sounds so entitled. Like, you know, just this being a best-selling author gig, the money's not that great, is it? But so many people would kill for the opportunity to have a book published at all that, you know, you never want to say that to a group of readers. But it's something that you hear in the green rooms all the time. So it's that kind of thing. Those were the highlights.
So that first time around, did you do a lot of festivals and
yes.
those sorts of things?
Yeah. My career arc, if you were to graph it, it sort of starts high and then goes low and then goes high again. I forget if parabolas go up or down or maybe both, but it's a U shape. So that first book, The Lab, was a smash hit. I didn't realize that at the time. Like, I knew it was, I had assumed that the book was receiving a typical level of success when that was not at all the case. It was much more successful than other debut novels tended to be. And so I got to do a lot of festivals. It got a lot of reviews. It was published overseas. I made quite a lot of money, or what seemed like quite a lot of money, when I was 19. And then it was only in the next few books that I wrote that didn't sell so well that I realized, oh, actually, it's really hard to make a living doing this. I got to do a lot of travel, a lot of publicity. I got to go on TV and radio and stuff. And that was a baptism by fire because I didn't know how to do any of those things. And if you gave me the same opportunities again, I would no doubt do them all differently.
So how did you do it then? And what did you learn from?
Well, for example, when it comes to the media side of things, like the interviews, people would ask me questions and I would largely just answer them like you would in a normal conversation. And that has its appeal because I think you come across as kind of genuine. But also you don't move a lot of books that way. you need to have prepped kind of some funny stories about the writing or research process. And you need to be willing to talk about what makes the book good and kind of swallow back that embarrassment because, you know, you don't want to big note yourself, but you kind of have to. That was something that it took me that I didn't learn until the publicity tour was over, that kind of thing.
So in terms of talking your book up, what does that look like?
What does it look like when it's done well?
Yeah.
I'll let you know when I figure it out. I actually think the appropriate middle ground seems to be, so you can't tell people, look, my book is great because of this. I mean, you do have to secretly believe that your book is great, otherwise you'd never be able to do this job. But what you can say is the reasons that I wanted to, the thing that made me excited about wanting to tell this story in the first place is this. That's okay. Yeah. And I think that readers seem to respond to that. And when you are talking about the quality of the book itself, so you don't want to be falsely modest, but it's a great opportunity if you do want to talk up the book, and you should, you want to give credit where credit's due and talk about what a great job the publisher did, because I mean, it's only the author's name on the cover, but there's a huge team of people who do a huge amount of work on any given book. So when someone says to me that they liked a particular aspect about the story, I thank them, but I take that as an opportunity to tell them about how the first draft was different and the things that were wrong with that and the things that are right with this final draft, and give publishers the credit for making those suggestions, because that means you're still talking up the book. Hopefully you've still got a sale, but you're not coming across as someone who thinks you're amazing, who thinks too highly of themselves. Yeah. That's a really tough line to walk.
Well, I think that's a good way of doing it, though. That is a clever way of... Because there is that tendency that you can have to, thank you for saying that, that's very kind of you, but that's actually a nice way to accept a compliment.
I actually think when my first book came out, I went too far in both directions, probably. Like, sometimes I would people would talk up the book and I'd say, oh no, it's not that good, really, trying to be modest. Or I would say, well, what can I say, I'm a genius, because deep down I didn't feel like a genius, and I was trying to cover it by sort of bluffing and acting like, oh, I definitely belong here, so yes, I'm special. And in fact, in doing that, I was making it about me rather than about the book. That's another thing that first highlight of seeing my own name on a book for the first time. Now that I know a bit more, I'd almost be tempted to want to take my name off the books entirely. I feel like the more focus there is on the author, the less there is on the book. And I started reading a book last night by Michael Robotham. Oh, I told myself I wouldn't say that. Michael Robotham, that's his name. Don't call him Michael Robotham, but he's very good. And but I've seen him give lectures a couple of times now, and every time I see him give a lecture, it takes away some of the magic of what he does. I read his next book and I go, oh, I see what you're doing there. You know, it's like a magic trick, and now you know how it's done.
Because when he talks, he reveals some of that process.
Exactly. Or... And certainly there are books of his where, you know, the questions from the audience are, you know, how did you come up with the idea for such and such a story? And he says, oh, that's a true story, I read it in the newspaper. And then that kind of takes away some of it. So I guess it's very difficult, the media angle, because you need to kind of to not lose that distinction between promoting yourself and promoting your books, because the media is going to want to know about you, because that's the bit that they can focus on and it doesn't seem like an ad. But you need to be good at kind of turning the focus toward the book, which is, after all, the more important thing. And ultimately, most authors, or certainly me, I became a writer because I wasn't a talker. Or I don't know, maybe I was a talker, maybe I talked a lot, possibly too much. But in fact, maybe I said a lot of things that I wished I could take back. Whereas with writing, you have editing, you can take back anything you put down. So I don't know. It's why so many of the authors I meet, I go, wow, you're not very good socially. Like, I don't say that, but I think it. And then I think that's probably why you're an author in the first place. Yeah. Like, you're good at writing rather than talking, you know?
So do you enjoy that promotional side? Or it's interesting talking to the different people we've interviewed.
Yeah, I think it's scary the first time you do it. And then it becomes fun, and then it becomes boring and hard work. But what's nice about it is that there's another little bump of enjoyment anytime you have a new book out. So certainly I don't enjoy talking about the lab anymore, for example. Like, so the book's 11 years old. I've said, yeah, I know, this is the first time podcast. but that's okay. You know, I'm happy to do it because people are interested. But when Hangman came out, for example, which is my new crime novel, the media was so much more fun because I went, okay, I've been working on this in secret for 10 years. Like, I've had the opportunity to chat about it with friends, but no interviewer has ever asked about it. No reader has ever said anything about it because no one had ever read it until now. And finally, people are asking me questions about this passion project that I have. And so the result of that is that I'm 6 months in and I'm still not bored of talking about Hangman. So anytime, but presumably I will be at some point, but by then I'll have a new book out and I'll be excited about to talk about that. The only problem is that typically the book that you are supposed to be talking about is not the one you're working on. Mm. And so the most fun is talking about what you're working on right now, but
yes.
That's a terrible thing to be discussing in public. It almost kills it, you know. The more secretive you are about your project until you at least finish that first draft, the kind of the better it's likely to be,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's sort of catch-22, isn't it?
Yeah.
So interesting you call Hangman a passion project.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people think of writing as about inherently passion-based.
Yeah, actually, I know what you mean. Well, sorry, pardon me. That was a poor time for me to take a sip of water.
But some of the other stuff you felt because it was outside of the sorts of things you had been writing?
One of the things that took me a while to learn, I guess, is that now I only write a sequel to something that sells. So my first book, The Lab, it sold really well. I wrote a sequel because the story didn't feel finished and I had an idea for a sequel. So I wrote that sequel and it flopped. But then I still was passionate about and interested in that story. So I wrote another sequel that no one bought and then another sequel that no one bought. So those were terrible career choices on my part.
And do you think that The Lab was the best of those or
no,
do you think there's no reflection? No,
no, the third one was the best.
Yeah.
The fourth one I probably shouldn't have written but was probably still better than The Lab. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's hard to because the kind of reader I am now is different from the kind of reader I was. So I guess the me who wrote The Lab wouldn't have enjoyed book three of that series as much as book one. And there are still kids who come up to me telling me that they like it. So maybe I don't want to say disdain for The Lab. I am still proud of it, but I'm not a kid anymore is the thing. So it's no longer the kind of book that I like, which puts me in this surreal position of, it's not that I dislike my own book. That's not quite right, but I've just moved on. But so the books consistently got better, I think, in that series, give or take a little bit of meandering towards the end. But that doesn't really matter. I actually think The Lab there were probably a lot of readers who read The Lab and just didn't like it enough to buy a sequel, and therefore it didn't matter how good the sequel was because no one read that. So most series, as I assume, the audiences shrink over time anyway.
Yeah.
So every new sequel you release ideally gets you a bunch of new readers, but those new readers go to book one rather than to the one you've just released. It's like every time Lee Child releases a new Jack Reacher thriller, it's not going to be the best-selling Jack Reacher thriller. It might have the best opening weekend or opening month or whatever you call it, but it's what it really does is boosts the sales of all the others in the series. Anyway, so your question was about passion projects. Sorry, this is just a long way of saying that for example, I wrote 300 Minutes of Danger. It did extraordinarily well. So I wrote two sequels and three spin-offs. Hangman, there was no reason for me to do that. Like, it was, I already had, I don't want to say I already had a good career because that's not quite right. I was writing it during the dark years when no one was buying anything that I was writing. But it's completely outside of my genre. It wasn't going to appeal to any of my existing audience at all. It wasn't a sequel to anything I'd already written. And it wasn't going to get into any school libraries. I didn't think it was going to win any awards or have any kind of mainstream success because it's pretty controversial in terms of the content. But it was something that I was really excited about. I was writing the kind of book that I like to read again for the first time in a long time.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's why I call it a passion project.
And how do you find the fluctuation in sales?
Yeah.
Does that affect you as a writer, or you're pretty, you have enough sort of senses of self to be?
You mean in terms of my self-esteem? Or?
Well, in terms of, so if we look at the lab, you had, you know, a great amount of success, and then you sort of talk about the second one wasn't, you know, didn't have the same level of success. Is that a hard thing?
Yes.
Has that the roller coaster, if the career trajectory is sort of U-shaped?
Yeah, you're right. So my income, there's how solid you feel about your career, and then there's the money you're actually making, which are kind of separate things, I guess. And the more books you have out in print, the more stable your income tends to be, because one thing might sell really well and the other thing might sell really badly, but the income all balances itself out. I don't tend to, in terms of how well a book sells, my assessment of the book is not really determined much by the sales. Like, I'm a pretty spineless person, easily influenced by other people. So how I see my own books is strongly influenced by reviews, and it is strongly influenced by awards, which is a shame because I've never won any, but I've been sort of shortlisted for a couple. So whenever a book gets a shortlisting or even more than one shortlisting, I'm always like, yeah, that was a good book. but as for the sales, I see it largely as a crapshoot. I go, well, some things do really well, some things don't. And the ones that don't, I assume it's not that the people who didn't read it didn't like it. It's just that not enough people read it. So I can't blame that on the book itself. I can blame myself for not promoting it hard enough, but not the writing. That part of me is kept separate, I guess.
Yeah.
And this is a relatively new attitude, but so The Lab, Hangman, and 300 Minutes of Danger have been my three big successes out of the 20 or so books I've written. Those are the ones that sold really well. And 300 Minutes of Danger, I wrote it fairly quickly. The publisher had given me a brief, and when it came out quite close to another book I wrote called The Cutout, which was a book that I thought was much stronger, and I spent all my energy promoting The Cutout, and then quietly, unbeknownst even to me, 300 Minutes of Danger was becoming a huge success, and I didn't find out until I got this enormous royalty check kind of 6 months later, when I went, what have I done that led to this much money? And I sort of dug through and went, 300 Minutes of Danger is doing really well. So that was, so since then, I guess I've stopped worrying so much about the promotion as well, because that one, I did nothing for that. It just kind of through luck and good timing, I guess, and good marketing on behalf of the publisher, it just found its audience. So that was,
Okay, let's talk social media, specifically
YouTube, okay.
So I have spent quite a lot of time looking at all of your YouTube clips.
I am so sorry.
No, it's great. But what is really interesting about that is, so some of them, I don't know if there are ones earlier than 2009.
Yeah.
But that's, even if 2009, that's 10 years of YouTube content.
Yeah,
it's almost
like
a reality TV show. You can sort of, you know, how did that all get started, I suppose?
Well, I think if I, as a teenager, I used to read a lot of like girls and women's magazines, because the male alternative was Ralph magazine, which is now defunct and probably for good reason. But I always found there were, besides the quizzes like Does Your Boyfriend Treat You Like a Princess, I always found like some, there was often some really interesting writing in there. And one particular article was about how to boost your career prospects by setting up a MySpace. And so this is telling you how long ago this was. So, and I went, oh, so what's MySpace? Oh, it's like a website, but you don't have to pay for hosting or anything like that. And in fact, I already had like a blog that I wrote with friends, but we were kind of anonymous on it. It never occurred to me that you, that your stuff that you put up on the internet could like be beneficial to your career. So I got a MySpace. I started blogging about the things that interest me. Thank goodness MySpace no longer exists or in the same form, because then people would turn up all the stuff that I wrote, and I'm sure that I wouldn't want my name attached to any of it now. But MySpace encouraged you to make a video introducing yourself. So I made one and put it up there, and I made it with my brother. He was the cameraman. And that was so much fun that that when MySpace kind of became, I started uploading it to other places as well. So the stuff I put on MySpace, I started uploading to other places, including YouTube. And then when MySpace went defunct, I continued uploading things to YouTube. So this started out as a self-promotion thing, and I was looking for any way that I could boost my writing career. And I thought, well, I've got a camera, I have a bunch of musical instruments, and I know how to play them, so I know how to make the soundtrack to some stuff. And my brother's an actor, he knows filmmaking, we can make stuff together. And so eventually I realized that the amount of time and energy I was putting into this would have been far better spent, you know, writing and polishing my work. I'm not convinced that any of my YouTube videos, even the ones that have tens of thousands of views, have actually led to any book sales.
But the interesting, I was looking to work out which was the most viewed, which I think is how to make invisible bookends.
Yes.
88,000
views. Well, last I checked it was 50,000, but okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that was just because, so I happened to be fiddling with pens and paper and trying to work out a way to fix up my bookshelves, and I invented this invisible bookend thing using just paper and sticky tape. And so I thought, oh, well, this is a nice crossover between books and how-to videos and stuff, so I'll just make a quick video and maybe... And it didn't get very many views until it was featured on Lifehacker, and then it went through the roof. So not convinced it led to any book sales. Again, I should have been writing. But like writing itself... I think making the videos is a waste of time to promote your book unless you actually enjoy the process, and I do. And in fact, writing books itself is a waste of time unless you enjoy the process, because if you don't and you're just in it looking for a nice stable career with lots of money, you're much better off doing something else. But if you actually like it, if you feel compelled to do it, then it becomes very rewarding. So yeah, anyway, I can't recommend it as a strategy necessarily, unless you think it's fun, in which case definitely do it.
Now, my next question is about something we were talking about before we started, the name Jack Heath.
Yes, my pen name. And also my real name. One of my career regrets is that I wrote under my own name rather than under a pen name. But
is
again,
really?
Well, yeah, that comes back down to, I mean, I guess... Your first book, you kind of want to have your own name on it, partly out of ego. Well, in my case, it would have been entirely out of ego, but it makes a certain amount of sense because your first book, you have friends and family, and so your immediate family will buy it no matter whose name is on it. But distant friends and relatives who haven't seen you in a while might see it in a bookshop and go, hey, that person wrote a book, and they'll buy it. So it makes sense to have that to give your career a boost. But a lot of the happiest writers I've met at festivals are the ones who have pen names. And I think it's because from 9 to 5, I can be Jeff Lindsay author of Dexter. Outside of 9 to 5, I can be whatever Jeff Lindsay's real name is. And it's you've got this Batman Bruce Wayne kind of thing happening. And I think work-life balance is something we should all aspire to. So me telling people Jack Heath is my pen name rather than my real name, it's mostly just a security concern, especially since I have so many readers who... Maybe this is just the information age and maybe it's not considered creepy anymore. But the fact that there are so many people out there who know who I am and I don't know who any of they are, that's still unsettling a bit to me. But saying that Jack Heath is my pen name, A, stops anyone from trying to steal my identity because their first step will be trying to figure out what my real name is and they won't be able to figure it out. Unless they listen to this podcast, of course. But also it kind of puts up a kind of barrier between the author and the reader again, which I think doesn't just keep the author safe. It also helps the readers enjoy the books more. Like, I know from experience that when you meet some of these authors, they're lovely people. But as we were saying before, the better you get to know them, the more you can see what they're doing. And suddenly the book itself doesn't seem so miraculous. So anything you can do to put a wall between yourself and the readers, it's for their own good.
It's interesting because the move, in a more general sense, is far more in the opposite direction.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Publishers want you to be all over social media, exposing everything you do in the hope that that will that you'll do something that'll go viral, but only in a good way. It's that kind of attitude of, okay, you need to be promoting yourself all the time while also somehow writing books. And completely, absolutely be yourself, be authentic, but don't say anything stupid that or anything that could be even construed as stupid, because then, well, these days they can sue you and take the advance back. You know, there's this really difficult position that authors are in, and some authors, I think, do a great job of walking that line gracefully. Like Tara Moss, for example, is great on social media. She does so many things. She promotes them all really well. She somehow also manages to be a great writer and have a family and never seems to get into trouble. Like, people attack her on social media, but she handles it really well, that kind of thing. And then you've got other people. I mean, at time of recording, like, Roseanne Barr is the most recent example. Like, she, I mean, she's not a writer. And obviously what she said went beyond just the realm of, like, careless, but it's still the kind of thing where a tweet can cost you your career days, but you have to tweet all the time according to everyone. So yeah, that stresses me out quite a lot. I'm glad that I've gotten to the stage where I've written enough books that people, I've still got a career. I have readers who follow the books rather than my social media accounts. But the dream is getting to the Matthew Riley stage where he has millions of followers. He follows nobody. He tweets about once a year and the tweet is, my new book is out, and there's a link to the book, you know.
So there won't be any Jack Heath Kardashian-style reality shows in the...
That is my worst nightmare, actually. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't... I like to stay out of... No one who knows me believes this, but I actually don't like the attention.
All right, last question. I am about The Helpline. My first novel will come out in September this year.
Congratulations again.
Thank you. What piece of advice would you give a first-time author? Me or a first-time author?
I don't know how practical this advice is, but remember to have fun. I think it's so easy to get wrapped up in the thought of having to do this perfectly and worrying about the reviews and like training for the media stuff and trying to work out what you should write next. So you can spend so much time strategizing that you get to a point where it's over and you realize you kind of missed it. It's a bit like your school formal where you spend all the time taking photos instead of actually having a good time. And I think I don't know if it's fair to say that's what happened to me, but it is to an extent. And one of the things that I've learned is that there's so much luck involved that you may as well just have a good time. I don't want to say it doesn't matter what you do, but it almost certainly doesn't matter as much as you think it does. So just meet some people, remember to smile and save up lots of interesting memories for the future harder publications.
Thank you. And thank you, Jack, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
To find out more about Jack Heath and his books, go to our show notes for this episode at thefirsttimepodcast.com. And don't forget to share the love if you're liking the show. Let us know what you think at The First Time Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre and RMIT School of Media and Communication.